Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Sainthood, Religion, and the Decline of Magic in the Early Modern World. Two conversations this week on Soundings. My guests are Carmela Franklin of St. John's University and Sir Keith Thomas of the University of Oxford. Soundings begins this week with a discussion about saints and sainthood. I'll talk about those topics with Carmela Franklin. Following that, a discussion with Sir Keith Thomas about his book on religion and the decline of magic in the modern world. Carmela Franklin is a professor of history at St. John's University in Minnesota. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she's working on a study of the Persian monk Magundat Anastasius. Carmela Franklin, welcome to Soundings. Let's talk about saints. How far back does the term go? Where do we get the idea of saints, sainthood, saintliness?
Well, in Christianity, it really goes to the very beginning of Christianity, although there are no precedents in the New Testament or even in Judaism. The saints really are the successors of the martyrs. The martyrs, those who were persecuted and spilled their blood, gave up their life to remain faithful to the faith of Christ.
Do they have anything to do with the pagan gods? I mean, where do we look for the models,
yes,
all of that?
Well, in a sense, you could say that the saint is the Christian hero. Mm-hmm. In fact, even in the iconography of the saints, you know, the pictorial representation of the saints, we sometimes find example of this transference of pagan cults to the Christian saints. For example, we all know the halo of the saint, right? And the halo is really no more than the classical nimbus, a Hellenistic circle which was placed behind the heads of semi-gods, of heroes, particularly Apollo, uh-huh, symbolizing the sun, of course. So from there, it moved into Christian iconography, symbolizing the fact that these saints are now in heaven, now, that they live in heaven.
Where do we locate the beginning of the, shall we call them the saints or saint? I mean, the concept of saintliness certainly doesn't originate with Christianity, but our notion of the saints,
yes,
as a group does, I take it.
Because we associate, when we think of the saints in the history of Christianity, we're really thinking of the cult of the saints, you, uh-huh, know, the cultural material manifestation of the saints. Certainly there have been holy people,
right,
throughout the history of the world, one imagines, but the Christians used the saints, first the martyrs and then the saints, as examples to emulate, as people who can strengthen you in your faith.
Mm-hmm.
From there, already by the second century of the Christian era, we find that the saints were used as intercessors. Mm-hmm. They are called the friends of God.
Mm-hmm.
You
so
want
the
a favor?
Between,
yeah,
right,
the go-between. Mm-hmm. You need a favor. Your daughter needs to have the devils cast off her.
Let me take you to my friendly, yeah, neighborhood saint.
Exactly. So the, uh-huh, saint is an intercessor, is somebody who procures you favors through, the church was adamant to insist, through the powers of God. It, uh-huh, is God who manifests his powers.
All right, now who picks the saints? How did a saint get to be a saint?
That is a very interesting question. In the early Christian period, throughout the Middle Ages, people picked the saints.
Popular democracy.
Exactly. In other words, the cult of a saint would originate. Why? It's always a very individual case. For example, a tomb might become a holy place. Of course, the cult of the saints is really also connected to the cult of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And all Mediterranean societies had, to a certain extent, a cult of the dead. so that perhaps miracles or wondrous portents would be performed.
Some special significant moment in local history.
Exactly, in the local place of the saint. And, of course, saints are also invented. We mustn't forget that. Not all saints are authentic. So it was very much a reflection of popular piety, popular cult. It's not until the late Middle Ages that the church hierarchy introduced the formalization of this process.
Well, tell me about that institutionalization that occurs. Does that separate the saints from their constituencies? What does that do to transform this relationship?
I think once you have that kind of institutionalization, then you still continue to have the recognition that a saint is created to a certain extent by popular devotion, by the cult.
Uh-huh. But ratified by the hierarchy.
Exactly. I think the first example of a saint who's, as you said, ratified, who's officially canonized, comes from the 10th century. Uh-huh. Later on, by the 13th century, no saint could really be venerated unless the church had given its imprint. But of course, what you have later on in more modern history, and I'm not really a student of modern history, is that political reasons come into play. For example, you might say that some English saints are the result of the divisions among Christians.
You know, isn't there a man named Fox who has a history of the martyrs, that kind of thing? And so we have a lot of political influence there.
Exactly. So that you really have politicization, the politicization of this process.
Tell me, Carmela Franklin, about some of your favorite saints. Is there an all-time top 40 saints list scholars agree about or disagree about?
One of my favorites is actually Saint Christopher, who now we are told is no saint at all. Saint Christopher, there is no evidence for a Saint Christopher early in the history of the church, but already we have evidence of a cult of Saint Christopher by the 5th century. Supposedly he was being executed, and we are supposed to believe that this happened in the 2nd century, and while he was being executed, a drop of his blood fell on the king who was trying to execute him and healed him instantly, so that Saint Christopher... Then the image of St. Christopher was placed at the entrance of churches.
So we have an instant saint here, do we not? I mean, it happened right there on the spot.
Exactly. So that you look at his image and you'll be okay for that day. But what's interesting to me about St. Christopher is really how the cult of the saint is driven by artistic and all the cultural needs. So... people began to invent stories about St. Christopher, and many of these stories have to do with his name. Christopher means the God, the Christ bearer.
Yeah, he who bears
Christ. So you carry Christ. So in the Middle Ages, then you begin to see pictures of St. Christopher carrying the infant Jesus. By the time you get to the 15th century, when you really have this tremendous development in the iconography of the saints, St. Christopher is portrayed as an old man crossing a river and carrying a full-grown bearded Christ on his back.
So they grew up together.
Exactly. They grew up together. So
What about the tension between the idea, the rather abstract and bloodless notion of saintliness, that celestial intermediary, mm-hmm. on the one hand, and then on the other, these really violent, awful things that happened to these people that produced their sainthood.
Yeah.
What about that?
Well, not all saints, of course, suffer these awful things.
They sacrifice in one way or another.
The early saints, of course, did, the martyrs. So that the problems then for the early Christians was, okay, in the 4th century, Constantine had legalized Christianity. Right. There really not going to be that many more martyrs, not normally. So what do we do?
We start living right.
Well, we start living right, but also we start turning to people who live particularly ascetic lives. Uh-huh. the saints of the desert, you know, the man who lives with his wife for 18 years and never has any sexual contact with her. So that when martyrdom was no longer possible, then a substitute martyrdom had to be invented or had to be seen.
What about these tactics of people who go off and live on the tops of, what do you call these things, big pillars?
Yes,
and they're
the
up
pillars,
there for 20
the
years
poles,
at a
yeah.
time?
Yeah,
did these things
the
really happen?
Well, we have, you know, that brings us to another big question, which is the lives of the saints, the hagiography. What was really true? What did really happen? When the hagiographer, when the person who wrote the life of a saint wrote that text, he wasn't necessarily telling just the truth. As somebody once said, he wasn't painting a portrait. He was creating an icon.
A snapshot.
Yes, and so what he has to do is both tell us the life of the saint, but also tell us what makes him a saint. How is he exemplary? You know, all saints really, or categories of saints, behave in a certain way. There mm-hmm. is a certain behavior. And often what those texts tell us is not only what the saint or this person did, but also tells us a lot about the religious sentiments of a particular age. Mm-hmm. You know, what is our religious ideal? St. Francis was a very popular saint. St. Francis of Assisi is a very good example, because if we look at the early representations of St. Francis, both the written lives, the written text, as well as the portraits, the iconography of St. Francis, we find him to be a very happy, joyous, calm sort of man.
And so, what's he become?
Well, after the Reformation, we have a very moody St. Francis, a kind of mystical St. Francis, and I might remind you of the famous El Greco portrait of St. Francis, in which he has a skull. Yeah. You see, these are very two different portrayals, and it really reflects the kind of Giotto-esque 13th century on one hand, and the post-Reformation mystical 17th
century. The transition that the saints experience. What about saintliness, the idea of being a saint, sainthood with respect to the popular culture, from high art to low? Mm-hmm. Does the concept of the saint reflect these, again, local circumstances?
Well, there is a great disagreement about that. You see, that question that you're really asking is the result of almost sort of the Enlightenment, which saw the cult of the saint as an expression of popular culture. How could an educated person believe in this stuff? In fact,
no, they do.
Exactly. And I think that is the wrong way to look at it, because it imposes our own prejudices.
How should we look at it?
Now? Well, we should look at it in its own terms. We should really notice that very educated people in the Middle Ages mm-hmm. venerated the saints. The most famous example is Gregory the First, also known as Gregory the Great, one of the most important popes in the history of the church, and probably one of the most educated men in his own age, you know, the one who converted England. He wrote a whole big book called The Dialogues on the Lives of the Saints.
And this what, legitimated it, authenticated it for the popular sensibility, the masses, so to speak?
Yeah, not only the masses, but also the educated people. Mm-hmm. In other words, I would maintain that we don't have here the masses venerating the saints and the elite not venerating the saints. I think we have the cult of the saint is a pervasive cultural manifestation and religious manifestations throughout the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. Different saints work for different times. For example, a fascinating topic you might want to explore sometime is women saints. Women saints become extremely popular in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance. I mean, the greatest saints of that period were women. And the question is why?
Carmela, I thank you for your conversation about the saints. We'll save this topic for another recording session. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Carmela Franklin teaches at St. John's University in Minnesota. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During a fellowship year at the center, Carmela Franklin is working on a study of the Persian monk Magundat Anastasius. Soundings on religion and belief in the early modern world continues now. My guest on the following portion of the program is Sir Keith Thomas, president of Corpus Christi College at the University of Oxford. Sir Keith Thomas is the author of Religion and the Decline of Magic, published by Charles Scribner's Sons. Let's begin with some generalities about your book about magic. Is magic still alive in the modern world?
Well, in a very different form, I think. One of the points I was trying to make in Religion and the Decline of Magic is that what we now call magic had considerable intellectual standing. At the universities, for example, conjuring spirits was a fashionable vice, rather like drug-taking today. It was thought the world was full of spirits which could be captured.
So it's not fair for us to look back and say, oh, these ignorant people and their superstitions. That is just not the right attitude to take.
No, absolutely not. I start with the assumption that people in the past were as intelligent as they are today. Mm-hmm. And I ask the question, why should people in the past have believed in things which we today think are absurd or crankish?
Well, give me some generalities about the relationship between magic, however we choose to define that, and the medieval church. Was it as benighted as the popular stereotype would have us believe?
Well, the medieval church meant different things to different people, but I think at the popular level, it was regarded as a great resource of supernatural power which could be brought to bear on daily life. There were masses and benedictions and blessings which it was thought would give you would bring you good fortune in your daily work.
Now, what were people after? They wanted protection from the malevolent spirits. They wanted answers to immediate practical questions. That kind of thing was going on, wasn't it?
I think mostly they wanted what we want. That's to say, they wanted good health, and they wanted advice about what to do at difficult junctures in life.
All right, and what kinds of voices did they listen to? How do we figure out this notion of medieval magic and make it understandable to modern audiences?
Well, I don't think it's very perplexing, really. In the first instance, people turned to priests for advice in the way they might turn to a psychoanalyst, perhaps, today. Secondly, they thought that hearing masses or engaging in religious ritual would bring them good fortune for the day. Mm-hmm. And they thought that ringing church bells would keep away thunderstorms. They thought that the church had a lot of power which could be used to help them in ordinary contexts.
Even though they would look at some of the priests and say these are fallible human beings who are committing grievous errors in their own lives, they would nevertheless place a certain residue of faith in the institution.
Absolutely. The priest's sacramental power didn't depend on his own personal merits at all.
What about prophecy? You have a section in your book, Magic and the Decline of Religion, about prayer and prophecy. That's not something that survives for the most part in modern religion, is it?
Well, it may not survive in modern religion, but it survives elsewhere. We have plenty of statisticians and contemporary commentators who write books about what life is going to be like in the year 2000.
Secular priests, is
absolutely
that it?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. What was, how did a medieval audience, how did they come to a word like prophecy?
Well, they thought, first of all, that the Bible contained a picture not just of how things had been, but of how they would be and how the world would end. Secondly, they thought that particularly holy people would have access to God's intentions for the future. They also believed that there were specially gifted figures in the past, like Merlin or Mother Shipton, many of these people didn't actually exist, who had foreseen the future. And there were many rhymes and verses in circulation, often of a rather Delphic kind, which they tried to interpret to fit contemporary circumstances.
And we don't place our faith in the modern world in these things anymore to the degree that the medieval sensibility would, because of statistics and science and all the rationality that surrounds it.
Well, I don't think it's particularly rational, but it is true that there are now other agencies. I mean, who help us when we have to take decisions in the dark. And after all, most of the decisions we take are in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
If you decide to get married or to change your job or to make a business investment,
you're taking a gamble.
You don't know how the future will turn out.
Right.
So you, these days, you call in what's called a consultant. And the consultant reinforces you in the view you already held.
What about healing, medicine, the practice of, do we call them the black arts, the magic arts?
Yes,
what was that all
not,
like?
I think not black arts. The villages of early modern England were full. I mean, virtually every one of them had a resident, a white witch, might be a man or woman,
mm-hmm.
who would claim to be able to heal you by either reciting prayers or by touching you or by giving you an amulet to wear or carrying out some other ritual. And we must remember that this was a time when the medical profession was quite incapable of healing anybody. It's not an exaggeration to say that for all their intellectual pretensions, the physicians and surgeons did nothing whatsoever to prolong human life before at least the end of the 18th century.
You say in your book, Man and the Natural World, that there was, who is the aristocrat that you cite who says that I'd rather go to an old wife, a village crone, far and away before I'd go to one of these professions?
Yes, well, a great many people have said that, yes.
Talk to me for a few minutes, Sir Keith Thomas, about astrology. This is a wonderful word that circulates in the modern world, the object of much contempt or admiration. What was it like to the medieval mind?
Well, astrology today is thought of as occult and vaguely mystical and superstitious. I think it's important to realize that astrology in, say, the 16th century was rather like science today. That to say, it was a serious intellectual attempt to explain why things were the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
And
people looked at the stars and they said, this is what we've got to work with, and therefore we'll put some faith in them.
They believed that the stars influenced life on Earth. It wasn't absolutely unreasonable. They associated with the weather in the first instance, and then the weather influenced the crops, and the crops influenced people's fortunes. And they thought that by serious study by correlating the movements in the heavens with events on Earth, they could arrive at patterns and laws.
This grew out of this whole notion of a hierarchy, did it not? That there was a way, after all the complexity of the world, to figure out the relationship between you, the tiny individual at the bottom of the chain, and then these large forces at the top of the chain.
Yes, that's absolutely right, I think. It was thought that the earthly and heavenly substances were different in kind, and that the substances of the heavens had an influence on the earth and shaped it.
What about people who could use the substance or the influence of the heavens malevolently? That is to say, you mentioned white witches a moment ago. Do we call them bad witches, black witches, what?
Yes. Well, they were just called witches, I suppose, but black witches to distinguish them from the white witches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was thought in this period that there were a lot of black witches who deliberately set out to do harm to others by occult means.
And who motivated them? Was it the devil? Was it this Manichaean sort of the good guys and the bad guys? How did all of that work?
Well, in the eyes of the educated intellectuals, it was the devil who was behind it. But in the eyes of the ordinary villager, it was just that these people were thought to have some special power in the way that the white witches had some special power. And I don't think they thought too much as to where that power came from. But I should say this is what was thought. In my view, the great majority of those accused of witchcraft were framed. That's to say, they were never, ever attempting to do harm to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Haven't there been books written about how witchcraft essentially was a political or an ideological exercise? That is to say, serving the means as well as the ends of people who wanted X out of position Y so that something political and local could happen.
Well, it's perfectly true that virtually every political conspiracy of the period took the advice of an astrologer or a conjurer. But that's not typical of witchcraft as a whole. The normal situation was that the witch was a perfectly harmless person, usually an old woman, who called at her neighbors, asked to borrow something, was turned away empty-handed. Mm-hmm. The next day, something went wrong in the neighbor's household, and she was held responsible. Now, sometimes she may have muttered a curse when she left, but very often she hadn't said anything at all, and it was the neighbor's guilty conscience which led to the accusation.
Mm-hmm. Let me put a very large question on the table for you, Sir Keith Thomas. Why did magic decline?
Well, it is, as you say, a large question. But essentially because the whole cosmology, the scientific view of the world in which magic made sense, that changed. The scientific revolution of the 17th century made nonsense of the picture of the heavens which the astrologers held. It showed that the universe was infinite, there was a plurality of worlds, things were infinitely more complicated than they'd thought, and it also suggested that the heavens were just as corruptible as the earth, there was no difference in kind. It debunked the whole notion of astral influence.
Well, what about the people who would have a vested interest in the perpetuation of magic as an institution or an influence in the world? Surely they just didn't give up overnight. It just didn't disappear quickly.
I think that's absolutely right. What happened was that from the point of view of the educated, the intellectual, and the upper classes, magic became a joke. And the church court ceased to prosecute white witches, and the assize court ceased to prosecute black witches, and witchcraft ceased to be a crime. But at a popular level, the village conjurer and charmer continued into the 18th and 19th centuries, and at a popular level, people still read their horoscopes today. Mm. But the difference is that those horoscopes have not got any foundation in the accepted science of today, in the way that they did in the 17th century.
Sir Keith Thomas is president of Corpus Christi College at the University of Oxford. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Sir Keith Thomas is the author of Religion and the Decline of Magic, published by Charles Scribner's Sons. Sir Keith Thomas recently visited the center in connection with the dedication by Oxford University Press of its new facility near Raleigh, North Carolina. Soundings on Religion and Belief in the Early Modern World is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 536. That's program number 536. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about artificial intelligence and about public policy and the profession of economics in the United States. My guests will be Roger Penrose, another recent visitor to the center from the University of Oxford, and Michael Bernstein of the University of California at San Diego. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.